We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, Big Screen Sports listeners, quick note about today's episode. This interview with director Thaddeus Matula was going to be about his two 30 for 30s, The Pony Excess and Brian and the Boz. Pony Excess is one of my favorite 30 for 30s ever, and Thaddeus was extremely generous with his time, generous with his stories. So we went all in on the Pony Excess this episode. So, you know, in the beginning, I say we're going to be talking about both. This one, just talking about the Pony Excess. Hopefully next week, maybe the week after, going to have Thaddeus back on to talk Brian and the Boz. But like I said, very generous with his time, tons of great stories, as much info as I could have ever hoped for to get on this movie. Hope everyone enjoys. Thanks for listening.
I'm Chinee Ogwumike.
I'm Lisa Leslie, and we're very excited to tell you about our new podcast with Blue Wire, Front and Center.
Lisa and I are breaking down what's going on in our lives, in the world, and keeping it 100.
We're also learning from amazing guests as well, like Emmanuel Acho.
People that show love to me, I forever got their back.
Vivica A. Fox.
If the foundation isn't right, then the rest of it's going to go wrong from there.
And more.
Subscribe to Front and Center today.
Blue Wire.
All right, welcome back into Big Screen Sports, the sports movie podcast brought to you by Blue Wire Podcast, and this week presented by Indeed and BetOnline.ag. I am your host, Kyle Bandujo. Before we get going, make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts, and if you haven't yet, please take the time to leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. You guys know the drill. Also, check out past episodes, as most content on this pod is evergreen. Check out, see if we've covered one of your favorite sports movies. Now, I am incredibly excited to introduce today's guest. He is the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning director of the sports documentaries The Pony Excess and Brian and the Boz, Thaddeus Matula. Thaddeus, thanks so much for joining Big Screen Sports.
Well, thank you, Kyle. I'm really glad to be here with you, and I'm glad that you're doing these podcasts, and it's just exciting to talk about these two movies any opportunity I get, so thank you.
These two are, as far as 30 for 30s go for me, are two of my favorite, especially Pony Excess, which was it was early in the 30 for 30 run, if I remember correctly. And I've always I'm a huge fan of this movie. You are about to get a ton of questions about it. But before we get into that, you have a project upcoming. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I'm working on a screenplay that we're going to shoot here early next year called As I Live and Breathe, which is a post-apocalyptic film. It's about an ex-special forces operative and an autistic boy, a boy with autism, and basically they're trying to survive the apocalypse on their own, hidden away until a person comes in who needs their help, and then they go on an adventure. So it really is exactly like a sports documentary, you know, in every way. That's a joke.
There have been, I will say that in the course of doing this podcast, we've covered a few movies that are quote unquote non-sports movies, but it's incredible how often you can find a parallel between something else in sports, although a sports documentary is a whole different kind of beast than a post-apocalypse movie.
Sure, and I also do conservation documentary work, and it's interesting how doing the sports film work has aided me in that, in the sense that I've discovered in doing sports docs that I can not necessarily make, but I can bring people in to root for teams that they would normally not root for, or at least for the time of the film happening. You know, so I lived in Austin up until about a year ago, and so I made Brian and the Boz while I was living in Austin, Texas, and so many of the people I knew were Longhorns, and to be able to have that movie come out and be in Austin, it was a great thing to sort of run into all these people who were able to really get behind the movie and enjoy it, even though their fandom was of the other side. And so I've taken that kind of idea where that if you can just connect an audience member to the passion of the individual, and in sports documentaries, it's in these team sports of the people coming together, setting aside differences, whatnot, to go after this common goal, you can bring the people in to root for that team. And then so using that in something like a conservation documentary, where instead of hitting someone over the head, like, we have to save these frogs or these other things that don't affect your and I's daily life. Like, it's not going to change the fact that we can go get a coffee or whatever if this one species go extinct. But if I can bring in the people to sort of like understand that here's a guy or here's a group of people or a woman that's giving their all to this cause, and you just follow the persons or the people, individuals, etc., on this journey, you can get the audience to root for that. And whatever, you know, other thing you have going on, it's not like, you know, you're not hitting them over the head, but they can understand that X, Y, or Z, like, more than 3/4 of frog species are critically endangered. And who knows that? And why does that care? Why does it matter? But I mean, like, that's just a fact that can come out. So I'm sure I've bored all your listeners now by telling you that.
Well, that's the interesting thing about documentary films, at least from it's just the nature of the film is it brings the listener this. A lot of people watch documentaries for new knowledge, something that you did not know. You like to feel immersed in a subject and kind of feel like an expert on a subject. At the end of a good documentary, you feel like an expert, even though you are probably not. And one reason that I love, the 30 for 30 series in general, but especially these two films, is that you did such a good job of taking the viewers into this college football history and making them feel so well-versed in that and telling these incredible stories. Because for me, as a child of the 90s, I was aware that SMU is, you know, got the death penalty. I didn't know, impermissible benefits, I didn't know what really went into that and how big a deal that was and how that came to be. Brian Bosworth, I knew who Brian Bosworth was, but I knew of some of those antics, but I didn't really know the story of how big a deal. And you take the viewer into how big a deal both of these things were. Because again, growing up a child of the 90s and growing in Texas, SMU has been a doormat for, you know, 30 years now because of this death penalty. So it was very interesting. So, kind of walk me through your career, you know, how you got into the 30, how you ended up working on the most groundbreaking sports documentary series ever created.
Well, so my father was a professor at SMU for 40-something years. He only retired 2 years ago when he turned 80.
And has a cameo in the movie.
He does. He's there. He's right there. As he's said to me a number of times, he's very pleased that 30 years ago he knew exactly the right thing to say to be in my movie 20 years later.
Good foresight.
It was great. So I grew up, I have an older brother who's 9 years older than I am. And obviously when I was a little kid, I wanted to be just like my older brother. And he loved SMU football. We had season tickets we didn't have season tickets because we had, we had faculty tickets to the games. And so I would go every Saturday, and it was just a really big part of my very early life. My earliest sports memories are of Eric Dickerson running down the sidelines at Texas Stadium with a jersey half torn off. And then I remember, I think it was like Vince Coleman for the Cardinals when his leg got rolled over by a tarp or something like that before a game when they were... Anyway, so those are like... I haven't told the Vince Coleman one.
Two ever. Very different You could do an amazing documentary in those 80s Cardinals teams that were just flying all over the field.
For sure. It was, you know, I'm not from St. Louis, but my whole family is. I was the first one born in Texas. I was born in Dallas, but older brother, older sister, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, parents, etc., all born in St. Louis. So my love of baseball comes from being from a family that has that baseball DNA in it. And I'm a Rangers fan because I'm from the Dallas area. I was born in Dallas, etc. But certainly because of that, we paid attention to the Cardinals, and that was why I was watching all those games then.
So what got you into making the getting on board with the 30 for 30s? I'd imagine the story was something you wanted to tell.
Right. Yeah. Earliest sports memories were of seeing Eric Dickerson in person at Texas Stadium. I mean, I was probably 2 or 3 years old, right? I was born in 78. And I just have all of these memories of how excited we were to see where the Mustangs were ranked at the beginning of every week. And in fact, when SMU won against Pitt in the January 1st, 1982, or was it 1983? Yeah, January 1st, 1983, Cotton Bowl. At the end, I couldn't really read at the time, but at the end, the scoreboard said national champions with a question mark after SMU won. And I remember asking my brother what it said, and he said that. And it was, I remembered SMU definitely winning the national championship for years until I was an older kid and I understood that, no, they had given it to Penn State. But the point is that I had this early love of this, and I also had an early love of art. We had season tickets to the SMU theater. So we went to the plays, and I grew up going to symphonies and operas, etc. Just a very well-rounded childhood. But I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker. And when I was 8 years old, we got the death penalty. And when you're eight, everything is still uniquely yours. I mean, even though you can understand that you share experiences with other people, the experiences that you have are very singular. And so this was something that was mine that someone else took away and then said that we were cheaters. And it really was crushing. And it was like I had my heart ripped out. And, you know, when you're 8 years old, a year is like a decade or two. I mean, it's forever. And then to have this thing taken away for not just 1 year, but 2 years, you know, it was really traumatizing. And already having that idea that I wanted to be a filmmaker, I really had this strong tie that I want to tell this story someday. And my intention was always to do scripted films, narrative films, your traditional movies. And so my plan had always been to make what became Pony Express someday as a scripted film. And once I got to college, I started coming up with the idea that it was so big that maybe it needed to be a series. And then I get out of school and I've never done a documentary, and I've done some films in college and had some great success as a college filmmaker. I had a science fiction film I made my sophomore year in college, played nationally on PBS. So it was, you know, great early things, but never documentaries. And I had found myself, though, going 8 years without directing a movie from 2001 to 2009. And I had this moment where I had moved to Austin, Texas, in the middle of that. I mean, obviously, everybody knows Austin is in Texas. I don't know why I added that. not Boston, Massachusetts, but moved to Austin. And I just was like, you know, I need to do something, or I've got to stop calling myself a filmmaker. And so what could I do? And I called a producer buddy of mine, and I said to him, hey, I just want to get together. I'm going to lay out all of these different film ideas that I have for you. And whichever one you're most excited about, no pressure, I'm going to start on this following Monday and work full time on. And so we talked, and in the end, we kind of decided that, like, you know, over coffee, that one of my sci-fi ideas would be great. And then I asked him what he was up to, and he went through all these different things. And then he ended with that he was just helping produce a couple of football documentaries. And I'm looking at the guy, and I'm like, I don't think of this guy as a sports guy at all. And then I say, well, I've got this football story I've always wanted to tell. And as the words were coming out of my mouth, I was like, well, I got to talk to all these people anyway. Why not bring a camera? And so I get back to my office. I had started editing for money. When I worked in Austin, when I moved there, I took a tech job initially just because I needed to pay the bills, etc. You know, your traditional early 20s beer money, etc. But I got myself to a point where I at least was doing something in film, but it wasn't in film because I was just editing deer hunting videos, and I don't even hunt. I don't particularly like guns. And
gotta pay the bills, though.
You gotta pay the bills. But I get back to the office after that coffee meeting, and I call up the guy who was hiring me to do these deer hunting videos. And I call him up and I say, hey, I'm going to deliver this one on Friday. And I know you've got another video starting next week that you want me to do, but you're going to have to find somebody else because I've got a full-time gig. And I got to tell you, it was exactly 18 months to the day after that Monday that what became Pony Express premiered on ESPN after the Heisman Trophy ceremony, becoming the most watched documentary premiere in ESPN's history. So there really isn't a metric for that. From the guy sitting at the end of the bar talking about how he used to be somebody to the guy who's just had the most watched premiere with this film after, again, the Heisman Trophy ceremony. It was unreal. And by the way, I just want to go back and say one thing. So that video that I was editing that week was not even a hunting video. It was a seminar on deer feed. I was sitting there editing a three-camera
shoot.
Sounds
thrilling.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I'm grateful that I don't remember any of it. the interesting thing is that, like, there wasn't 30 for 30 wasn't a thing when I started out on this. It was something that I became aware of and obviously started to come out as we were making this, but I really decided that if I was going to get anybody, I was looking at it as completely independent, and I thought, if I'm going to get anybody to put their money into this, I have to put my single most valuable commodity into it entirely, and that's my time. And so without any money at all, I started, and I got eviction notices, I got my power turned off, I got my cable turned off, all of these things, but it was all in the service of, I have to do all of this to make sure this happens. And around that same time, I was late to getting on Facebook, but right before this happened, I had finally gotten onto Facebook. This is 2009. And one of the first friends, the first day I was on, was one of my high school buddies. And he said, hey, our friend so-and-so is now out in Los Angeles, and he's just started his own film company there after he had worked for both ESPN and Fox. So a little later on, when I'm starting this, I think, well, you know, if I'm going to be raising money for this, it'd be nice to have someone's name in the packet that you know, has a tie to some sports TV. And so I call my friend, Michael Hughes, and I just say to him, hey, look, I have something that I might need your help on, and I really don't need you to do anything on it. I just want to use your name in the package so that there's some kind of credibility with ESPN and with Fox. He had worked, you know, on the Fox NFL studio, national Fox, not like one of the Fox Sports Net. And so anyway, I just lay out this whole thing of here's how I see the story, here's how I want to tell it, here's everything that goes into it. Really close, I have to say, to the final product. And I talk for a good, you know, hour straight. And at the end, I stop and there's a pause. And then I'm like, that bad, huh? And he says, no, I wish I would have thought of it. And then I was like, well, look, I don't need you to do anything. I'll just, you know, I'll put your name down as associate producer and it'll be fine. And I was like, do you have like a bio that I can put in here? And if not a bio, like a CV, you know, just what you've done. And he's like, I'll take a look. And so the interesting thing is, associate producer, there's a joke in one of those movies about movie making where someone asks the other person, oh, what's an associate producer? And, you know, in this typical chauvinist smug era that this was made, the response was, oh, that's the title you give your secretary instead of a raise. So I just asked my pal to be an associate producer on this, but that was really because I didn't need him, didn't think I needed him to do anything. And so a couple weeks later, I'm putting together the packet and I call up, Mike Hughes and I say, hey, look, do you have that bio? And he said, no, but I'll send you, my CV. So he sends it over to me and I'm looking at it and, you know, we're maybe at eight, ten years at most out of college at this time, 8 years. And his resume there says that he's won like 15 Emmys. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know if I've bought 15 pairs of shoes since college. And so I call him up and I was like, hey, Mike, did I say associate producer? I meant executive producer. But unbeknownst to me at the time, I made a bio for him. I put it in, but crazily enough, so I went to Jesuit in Dallas, and one of the big things about, you know, this is not unique to Jesuit in Dallas, but it was really instilled in us this idea of brotherhood, and that, you know, when another Jesuit grad, especially from our class, you know, would call or need help or whatever, you did it. And the brotherhood just goes deep. And it doesn't just end at your class. It extends beyond, you know, it's always exciting to meet someone who has gone to Jesuit. And I bring all this up because my friend Mike, he won one of his Emmys that very year. And in our alumni magazine, it had said that two different people from Jesuit had won sports Emmys that year. And sports TV is a tremendously small world. And my friend Mike couldn't believe that there was another person from our high school who won a sports Emmy that he didn't already know. And so this was just a thing to him, and I bring this up because the week after I ask him, will you be involved in this, and he says, you know, anything you need, I want to help make this happen. He's at a party in Los Angeles, and he meets a guy there at this party who happens to be that other guy from our same high school, from Jesuit, his partner, his filmmaking partner, And that guy says, hey, you know, my partner's here at the party. So my friend Mike then goes and meets this other guy who won a sports Emmy the same year. And they start talking and, you know, it's just a great conversation. And Mike asks these two guys, John Dorsey being the other guy from Jesuit. He asks these two guys, well, where'd you guys meet? And the other gentleman is named Andrew Stefan. So John and Andrew, they met in college when they went to school at SMU. And my friend Mike is like, you know what? I've just been brought in on this SMU project. So that happens.
Very serendipitous kind of thing of all these SMU Dallas people being brought in on this project.
Exactly. Yeah. So my buddy who went to Jesuit, who went to high school with me, he actually went to Wash U in St. Louis for his undergrad. But yes, it's, then there they are in L.A. and he meets these guys who are partners and went to SMU. And so those two guys tell my buddy, hey, we want to be involved. Anything we can do to help, you know, we're in. And so I didn't know about this until months and months later. The following week, so this is just 2 weeks after I've called my friend Mike, these two guys are in New York and they're having dinner with an old friend of theirs who's now an executive on this new series 30 for 30. And she is despondent because they've just lost one of their 30 films. And these two guys, John and Andrew, are like, have we got the film for you? And so they pitched this, and again, it's really months later before I hear any wind of this. But the fascinating thing is when Bill Simmons initially pitched the idea of doing this 30 for 30 series. It was initially 30 films for 30 years. ESPN was celebrating their 30th birthday, and as Bill Simmons joked, ESPN's like the guy you know in college who has his own party for his 21st birthday and buys all the kegs and invites everyone over. And so this was their, you know, their thing for their 30th. But when he pitched it to the rest of the people at ESPN, his higher ups, he, one of the films that he had in mind was like, and of course we'll do an SMU death penalty film. And apparently they had gone as far as bringing in a production company to try and find a filmmaker who would be ripe for making this. The 30 for 30 series as it exists now is really not as strict rule-wise as it was in the beginning. In the beginning, it was they very much wanted to find filmmakers who had a personal relationship to the story that they were telling. And so I ended up being like the ideal person for them. I was pretty much the only unknown name of the original 30 directors. But because I had this DNA that they were looking for, it really everything was serendipitous. I mean, I talk about how I don't think I believed in God before doing Pony Excess, and I don't know what it is, but something more than me wanted me to make this movie and do it on a big stage. And there's so many different signposts where it was like, I spent 8 years sort of like in the hinterland of emotionally, you know, what am I doing with myself and all these kinds of things. And I put some effort into this one thing, and then all of a sudden, all of these dominoes fall, and here I am. And literally, like that film would have probably taken 3 years if it was independent the whole time. But ESPN coming in and them having this new series, and they've got an opening. That's why it was so fast that we got it done in 18 months from the day that I started. And it was really like 9 months from the day we got the signed contract with ESPN, where we just went nonstop. But before that, I was doing everything independently, and I got to tell you, I had found an investor, a billionaire, which is pretty cool. Who was?
Those are always nice friends to have. You like having those billionaire investor friends?
Yeah, it was really incredible because I'm meeting this guy, and it's at an SMU function, an alumni barbecue right before the football team, a football alumni barbecue right before. I guess you would call that a Letterman's barbecue, right before the season started. And I meet a guy there who's like, I can't fund what you're doing, but there are a couple people here who can. Let me introduce you to a couple of them. And first one, obviously not interested. The words death penalty at SMU have always been bad words. You know, they don't want anything to do with it. But the second person he introduces me to, as soon as he says the guy's name, I'm like, this guy's name is on the building, and I'm like, well, I'm gonna keep. And he's excited about what I'm saying. And this was outside, by the way, I have to say. And I'm selling this guy, and I'm selling this guy. And again, it's outside, and I realize I can't move until this person moves. I can't do anything to end this conversation. And I'm really, really feeling something on my ankles. I'm standing in the grass and he's standing on the concrete. And I'm trying not to notice what's going on with my ankles. And finally, I look down and I'm standing in a pile of fire ants. So
for anyone who doesn't live in Texas, that is a full-blown nightmare.
It didn't hurt until I saw it. Before that, it was some sort of annoying thing is going on down below. The bugs are out. I don't know what's going on. And it was a nightmare. I mean, I was 30 minutes in that. And so it was amazing. I just slightly shuffle away to get my feet onto the paved part where he was standing. But that then showed that the conversation was over. So he stopped talking to me then, but I had stayed in it long enough that he ended up being my big investor in the film. And even, I guess, it wasn't an investor. He was just a donor.
Itchy ant bites probably lasted, you know, as long as it took you to do the film. Those things will hang on you forever. But once you get into actually doing the film, once you sign that ESPN contract, this movie is so effective because you corralled so many people who were in the thick of the SMU, the Dallas scene during that time. Who did you know you had to get? Like, the film doesn't work without these guys. Was there an essential roster of, or at least an essential person of, if you don't get these people, this film won't work?
Okay, so it's an interesting thing because I knew if I didn't get Eric Dickerson, the level of eyeballs wouldn't be the same. You know, we had to have that for star power. I really felt that I needed Sherwood Blunt. And in fact, he was like the first one I targeted. And if you've seen the film, you know that we didn't get Sherwood Blunt.
His name a lot in the film, though.
Yes, we do. And so, you know, the funny thing is that my biggest pitch to him was, if you don't end up in the film, you are going to look the most guilty.
Which he does. He looks super guilty.
Yeah, and I was trying to tell him that, look, here's the deal. If you come on and you present your case and you say, hey, look, I was tired of my college football team getting kicked around. I looked around, and it really seemed like everybody in the conference was paying their players. And I had become successful, and I wanted to see my team do well. And you know what? What's going to hurt? I mean, these are for the most part poor kids who are looking for a way out of their socioeconomic backgrounds. And if I can be there and help them sort of like have money to do something with their lives and get an education, et cetera, and I get to see winning football with it, whether or not the audience members agrees with that approach, they can start to understand at least that, you know, this is not just some sort of like evil mastermind, or I'm going to do these things and I'm going to break the rules just because I'm a bad guy, and then I'm going to get my university punished so badly. You know, it totally can make sense if you are a sports fan, if you were given the argument of like, hey, you know, everybody else is doing it, which is the argument he would have put out. Why shouldn't we?
And well, so and because he didn't talk, he comes off like an unruly mobster who won't listen to anyone and is just doing this for his own accord. The booster you got, the older gentleman whose name I can't remember, comes off as just a rich guy who likes college football a lot and wanted to help the kids and wanted to watch his team win. Like, he's definitely guilty, but he comes off a lot better than Sherwood Blunt does.
Certainly. And I mean, like, for these, you know, for these guys who put the money in, that was it. It was like, for a lot of them, it was just like, I'm just going to put some money here, right? And then it was interesting because one of the guys we interviewed was a guy by the name of Robin Budicky. And Robin is not an SMU guy. He was a sort of semi-professional bagman. And he was one of these middlemen who brought players to money guys, et cetera, within the Southwest Conference area. And so one of the great things, I don't even think we really got into it in the film, but Ron Meyer and his staff, not only were they recruiting these athletes, they went in and they recruited these bagmen. Like, who are the ones that are most effective at getting X kid to X school? Can we convince that guy to be a part of our team? And Robin Budke was one of those guys. And he, there's so many funny stories about him. You know, one, my favorite is he walks into a school and the football team, it's, you know, it's in December, the football team sees him and starts singing, "Here Comes Santa Claus." but yeah, so with Sherwood, you know, I mean, I even thought Sherwood would be great to invest in the film to get the film out there. Cause I mean, I was really convinced that like, all you got to do is make that case. And yeah, you're going to be like, and people are going to be like, oh, well, he did it. Well, of course he did it, but oh, I see why. And I mean, the issue though with Sherwood is the evidence still looks like when Ron Meyer left, rather than putting someone in charge of the football program who already knew about the recruiting and how they were doing it, they brought in this outsider from Mississippi, Bobby Collins. And Bobby
Collins looks like he's been run over by a train the entire film.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So like Steve Endicott, who is in the film, and
Endicott was holding no secrets either. That dude right. was just straight up the best part. I think my best part, my favorite part in the film is when like Eric Dickerson's like, "I'm not going to tell you about the Trans Am," and the booster's like, "You know, he got the car, and that's all we're going to say." And Craig James is like, "You know, Eric's not going to tell." And then Steve Endicott's like, "Yeah, A&M paid the down payment, and then we helped him out when he got to school. I'm just spilling everything."
Well, you know, the thing about Steve Endicott, he was like back then he was a young, good looking dude. Ron Meyer brought him in from Miami before Miami was the U. And it was this young staff that like a young, good looking staff. And Endicott sort of really embodied that. And the thing that was so a shame, you see Steve today and I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but he's really life has not dealt him a good hand since then. And I got the feeling from everybody that I talked to and from getting to know Andy that like he was the perfect person to hire to take over for Ron. But they didn't. They went with someone again who was an outsider. And the other thing is that Jimmy Johnson was at Oklahoma State at the time, right before he went to Miami. And the story is that the quote I got was, Jimmy would have crawled across broken glass to get the SMU job when Meyer left for New England for the Patriots. And so you kind of think if Endicott or if Jimmy Johnson would have taken over, that no one would have ever really heard about this. There would have been X, Y, and Z, but it would have been like, I mean, all of it's so the bad thing about being the Pony Express director and really loving SMU football at the same time is that when I go anywhere that's a big college town area and they find that out, everyone has a story about X booster doing Y that they feel like they have to tell me and then be like, it really sucks what happened to your college. I'm like, I know. And you just told me about what you guys were doing. Thank you. but the idea is that as we portray in the film, Bobby Collins really did just want to coach football and he didn't want to deal with all of this other stuff. And as the film goes into, you know, Dallas was a big ego place right then, and you couldn't get away with this with I'm just going to coach football like you could in Starkville, Mississippi. Funny enough, I just spoke to a class in Starkville, Mississippi the other week. Did a Zoom call with them, and that Saturday they ended up beating LSU, which seemed like a big deal at the time. because that was the first game of the season for LSU. And
yeah,
you thought
things
national
are shaking
team.
Out, shook out weird for both teams.
Right. And I have to say, you know, for the first, you know, for that next week after they beat LSU, I was like, yeah, you know, that was really me. I spoke to a class on campus and then they beat LSU. It's the Thad magic. You should have me call and talk to your classes and maybe you'll win some big games.
And then it turns out LSU is just bad.
They're, I mean, historically bad. Like, I mean, they have to, I'm sure I heard this on a broadcast and I'm not just pulling it out of nowhere, but I think they're the worst defending national champion in terms of record to open the next season. It's,
no, they have to be. Oh, it's crazy. But back into the Pony Excess, is there anyone who was like, your favorite get or a surprise get? Because, I mean, the roster that you pulled together for this documentary, I mean, you get Musburger, you get Uncle Vern, you got Dickerson like you wanted. So much great Dallas media. Dale Hansen, who's still out there doing it. Richard Justice, obviously Skip. Brad Sham, voice of the Cowboys. Mm-hmm. You get Craig James. That radio guy, Norm. Who is
Norm Hitzkiss, yeah.
Amazing voice. Was there anyone who was your favorite get or surprise get, like someone who, you know, you didn't think was going to be on board?
Well, I mean, I'm going to start with the one with another one that we didn't get, Keith Jackson. In the book, A Payroll to Meet, which was written about this scandal right in the immediate aftermath, in that book, it says that Keith Jackson called this game between Texas and SMU when SMU went down to Austin and beat them when UT was number two in the country and SMU was unranked. But I was able to get Keith Jackson's phone number, and this was like right then he was still the number one college broadcast, or no, I mean, this might have been right. No, this was a few years after he had done his last game, but I'm talking to him on the phone, and it's, I mean, it's literally Keith Jackson. Whoa, Nelly! the Crimson Tide of Alabama, and I'm
all
I'm talking
time
to him
incredible in, voice, all time right. Hall of Famer.
And he's like, "Well, Thaddeus, I've just gotten home." and I say, "Hey, I want you in this." And he says that he doesn't remember calling that game. And he says, "I'm an old fool, but not a damn fool. I don't want to be in your show and be wrong and make fools of us both." and so I didn't get him. But, you know, I mean, you know, obviously I wanted to get Dale. And interestingly enough, even as an SMU fan, I've been a lifelong fan of Dale Hansen. I was a fan of his before we got the death penalty. In fact, when I was a little kid at a summer camp, we did a fake newscast sketch when I was like 7. And I played the sports caster, and my name was Dale Hansen. That is not
very
a joke.
Clever. Very,
very, yes, that actually happened. My mother has unearthed a photo of that, and that is currently on her fridge of me as Dale Hansen. But, you know, I really, in the end, there were people that we didn't get, but there are so many people that we did get, because it was just kind of like, I want to talk to all these people. So we interviewed like 86, 88 people in 60 something days or less. I mean, it was crazy. There were days where we were doing 2 or 3 interviews a day. We were crisscrossing the state of Texas. It was amazing. And I mean, you know, we got Lou Holtz just because I wanted to make sure that story after we come back from the death penalty. And I keep saying we because this was very personal to me. But I think if you see the film, there's not really a we perspective in it. And I'll get back to that. I wanted to get that moment of these completely overmatched, basically just 1 year out of high school, kids going up to Notre Dame, to South Bend, to play the number one team in the country and just getting destroyed. I really was like, hey, if we can get Lou Holtz to give that other side of the perspective, that would be awesome. And so we went through everything, and it's so much fun being from Dallas and knowing the power of the Dallas Morning News sports page, at least traditionally. Obviously, all sports, all newspapers are struggling these days, but that was consistently picked as if not the number one, one of the top three sports pages in the country, and usually number one. It won like the award for best sports section in the country. All these, you know, so many years out of, you know, 30 years, they definitely won it the most. And so
you get
many
into that in the documentary too, because you talk about that competitive media environment in Dallas and that being part of the reason that the scrutiny was so big on SMU. I have a ton more questions on this, but Thad, let's take a quick ad break and then we will be right back.
Big Screen Sports is brought to you by Indeed. Even though sports had a break, your business didn't. You have to keep moving, and that makes hiring more important than ever. Indeed is here to help. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because Indeed gets you the best people fast. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You only pay for what you need, and you can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Plus, Indeed provides powerful tools to make your search that much easier, like sponsored jobs, which are shown to be 3.5 times more likely to result in a hire. With 73% of online job seekers visiting Indeed each month, Indeed is going to get you the important hire you need, just like they have for 3 million businesses. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job posts, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try out Indeed with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/BlueWire. This is our best offer available anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through December 31st. Big Screen Sports is also brought to you by our old friends at BetOnline.ag. The wait is over. Football is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on every possible chance to win the season. Game spreads, totals, team player, and coaching props. BetOnline gives you more options to wager than anywhere else. You can also get in on season opening bonuses today. Start off wagering on wins, division, and championship futures all day, every day. And that stuff changes week to week, so that's always open. Head to BetOnline today and take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. Don't forget to use promo code BLUEWIRE at BetOnline.ag. That's BLUEWIRE, all one word. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
All right, we're back talking the Pony Access with Thaddeus Matula. So we talked, you assembled this huge roster, and I assume you had to leave a ton on the cutting room floor, and you had a lot of these guys. The type of guys you had, I'm sure you had a lot of people just going on and riffing. Who had the best stories? I feel like I could have listened to Ron Meyer go on forever. I bet Dale Hansen had a ton to say about stuff from covering that team, covering that town. I also want to shout out Rod Jones. I thought he was awesome. Who, in your opinion, who had the best stories? If you guys were just sitting around tape rolling or tape not rolling, who was the most entertaining?
Well, I mean, that you said Rod Jones is great, because Rod was awesome. And he told us, he warned us, I guess, that like all of his teammates are going to think that we found an actor to play him, because he was like, in college, I said nothing. I never talked. I'm totally different now in terms of being, you know, I don't think he used the word loquacious, but that's the word I'm looking for right now. But Rod was fantastic. We did Rod Jones on like Memorial Day or something like that. It was a holiday. I'm trying to think. I always get confused as to those end of summer, beginning of summer holidays, whatever they are. But yeah, it was one of those days, Labor Day, and it was just perfect. It was so much fun to listen to him, and you know, there's so many highlights of doing these interviews and of sitting there for hours with some of these people. I mean, I really loved Brent Kershaw, edit that. I really loved Brett Kershaw. He was just someone who I was told that, hey, you've got to talk to Kershaw about being on that 89 team. And he was the guy who had the probably the line that gets the most or second the most laughs when you're seeing it with an audience talking about the 89 team. We weren't big, but we were slow.
That is a good one. Okay, now I know the guy you're talking about.
Yes, and he also told the story about like when they were in the locker room and how Forrest Gregg came into the locker room and was all, you know, just really fired up, like, who in here doesn't think we can beat these guys? And Kershaw says, and there was that one guy who raised his hand and said, Coach, I don't think we can beat these guys. But so, you know, I mean, the experience of interviewing Brent Musburger, I mean, I can't tell you how many times in the lead up to that, myself and my executive producer, Mike Hughes, also, I call Mike my executive producer, John Dorsey and Andrew Stefan, they were also executive producers. They were like the team, as I said, that had the relationship. So those three guys were my EPs. I usually consistently call Mike my EP more often because he was involved with me from that beginning time. But so Mike and I would way too often just break off on a "You're looking live," and to go to his place. I actually went there with John Dorsey, the EP who had also gone to Jesuit. So we drive out. We interviewed Musburger at his ranch in Montana, and like there aren't really interstates in Montana. I mean, like, flew into this rinky-dink airport, and then, you know, you get the rental car, and you have to drive out, you know, another hour or whatnot, and I'm just like, he must have an airstrip on his ranch because of all the travel he had to do, but
Uncle Brent, of course he's got an airstrip. Come on,
of course.
He's not going to the airport to get to Vegas. He's flying from the ranch.
Right. I mean, and like I said, there's not really interstates there. There were highways that seemed to be just dirt roads. It was eye opening. But we got out there and Dorsey, John Dorsey, he gets out of the car. We both step out of the car. It was like a movie scene because you get out and like it is this gorgeous giant ranch with nothing else there on this empty plain with then mountains all around. And John turns to me and says, man, I got to get in the game. it was perfect. And so Musburger was that when we got Musburger, the same trip, the same sort of mountain trip that we got. Why am I blanking on his name? You said his name, Vern Lundquist. So Uncle Vern. Yes. So we got Vern and we got Forrest Gregg all on that same trip. But like to be there and to, you know, interview Musburger and for him to talk about being an SMU fan as a kid was so cool because we also got that from Vern. And the idea was that for so many people, for so many years, SMU was an afterthought. And I'm even talking about before the Pony Express era, and then obviously after it. But there just wasn't the knowledge, the institutional knowledge of the college fan base anymore of SMU having been this power or this storied program that captured everybody's imagination. I mean, like, you know, the old joke, it's so old you don't even know it anymore, but like the old joke was, how can you tell the atheist in the room the one who doesn't know who to root for in the SMU Notre Dame game? And that was a big joke at one point, right? But to be able to then talk to these people and for Musburger to tell me about how big of a deal it was when he was a kid to get Doak Walker's autograph, it was really, those were special things for me because, you know, if your team, imagine your team is SMU or a team like it, of which there is no other one like it, but the program has been taken away from you at a young age, and you've had this very negative thing happen with it. And then you are constantly both piled on about it. If you're ever mentioned nationally, it's only about that. And then your team keeps losing. And, you know, I remember one of the reasons I wanted to make the movie is I have a cousin who's my age who grew up in Missouri. And, like, you know, I just couldn't explain to him why I was an SMU fan. He didn't get it. It's like they never win. Why are you a fan? And I remembered, I'm like, I'm making this to show Cousin Mike that we were good. You know, and I argued to the people at the school. It's like, you know, what I want to do with this is just to remind people that there was a time when SMU was really good, and that, you know, this is a big deal. And June Jones, who was the coach at the time, loved everything I was throwing down, and he knew it would be a big help for him in recruiting, because so many people, just if they knew SMU at all, they thought SMU sucks, right? Or they didn't know SMU. Or a lot of people knew that SMU sucked, but they didn't know that SMU was in Dallas. That was such a big thing that so many people don't. I mean, there are people, until we're now good again, there are a lot of people who, you know, who were from here who really didn't have an idea that SMU was actually in Dallas.
I was going to ask you about that. What was the reaction like from people around Dallas, especially like old hands who had been around when things were good? Do you think that the film or just the energy around that helped? Because SMU was, you know, like you said, was awful for 20 years. June Jones came in, things got kind of good, and then he left, things got not so good. And then last year, I think, was the first time they'd been ranked in ages. So as far as when this came out in Dallas, did you get a sense of how the city, how old, you know, SMU fans from the 80s received it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, really the only people that I think are still not happy with me about it are maybe the highest ups at the athletic department and the president of the university. I mean, I love Dr. Turner. He's been there forever. I actually, you know, was in college at the same time as his daughter. She was an SMU theater major. Dr. Turner has done a ton for the university, but he certainly didn't want anyone reminding people of this big black eye. But I mean, I may be making it up, but I always feel like there's a little coldness when I see him. You know, I think that, like, with the athletic department, at the highest levels, it's just more like, man, if we could have just gotten through and gotten a little bit more popular again without having that, maybe that would have been cool. But for the most part, like, every the reaction of so many people is just, yes, we looked at the darkest hour of this institution, but there's a lot of gratitude that film was put out, because it was able to show, you know, yeah, this is what happened, and yes, from an SMU perspective, we did do this, but at the same time, here's what we were, here's where we are, and this is where we're going. And my biggest commitment to this is that I wanted this to be a great film. I didn't want this to be an oh poor me story. So as much as I've said we in this, I really wanted to at every turn pull away any kind of bias I thought I might have in terms of just telling the story. The big thing that I felt that I had in my back pocket that 99% of filmmakers wouldn't have had, or even more, was the perspective of the unfairness of it. And what I mean by that is that the general media consensus of anybody who would talk about the SMU death penalty was just a negative thing on SMU. There was not, from a media perspective, a forgiveness factor, you know, And I mean, I learned the reason for that by doing the film, because there were a lot of SMU boosters who were absolutely unapologetic in their approach to this. You know, they didn't take the time to well, I mean, they might have, but in take the time to sort of explain themselves or whatever, or any of these things. They just were this. They were very much the TV show Dallas, you know, and it was all a game, and it was all, you know, we don't have to talk, and so there was a lot of an unbelievable level of arrogance about it, and so the media members that covered it at the time were not thrilled about that arrogance, and so thus the media story moving forward from that all came off of those people sort of having this complete negative view of SMU of being this lawless place. And I'm not saying it wasn't, but it's really hard if you weren't on the inside to at least have that level of empathy. But at the same point, I knew I couldn't go out and make an oh poor us type story, because no one would see that. You know, no one would want to see that. And I just felt like, you know, I'm not remembering it right now. I'm gonna use the old Google machine here in a second, probably. But the Latin phrase that is SMU's motto is basically "the truth will set you free." And so I kept telling everybody who was on the SMU on the inside, just come on and tell the truth, and it'll be good. We can move forward from this, because as a fan, the one thing that I really felt was that there was just this cloud over SMU athletics it always felt like a funeral for those 20 years, and there was no getting out of it. And I was just like, look, if we can just burst this bubble, if we can just pop this thing that's hanging over our heads, we can just move forward. But, you know, again, the cool thing, though, about then having that commitment to I really want to tell the story well, I got to enjoy the rise of the football program in there. And then I got to have that moment where I really realized that, oh my goodness, we really did this. We really did what they say we did. And no matter how much I could also show these other programs were doing the same thing, there was no way around me having to face the facts myself of this thing that we did. And even if I could say, hey, I get it. I mean, like, you know, the kids that were getting money were going to get money somewhere, and we just got good at finding those kids and getting them to the same place. But at the same point, you know, I really didn't have the come to Jesus moment. And you started this, I believe I jumped into this with like who was who had the most enjoyable stories or the best get. And like, it's, you know, it's been unbelievably, it's been 10 years now since we did this. And like, this is, you know, my interview with you now is one of the first times where I'm sort of realizing how all of that has kind of like merged together in a way, in terms of like the way I think of those interviews. And it's just, there's just such a glow around so many of them that like it was like life in wartime, you know, the group that went in and we made this film together. And you know, film in my estimation, in my mind, it's the ultimate team sport in arts, because while the quarterback or the head coach can get all the praise and all the glory, it's so many people who come together. And I personally was just someone who had a passion for this, and that passion was able to attract other individuals to want and come and be a part of this. But I wouldn't have been able to do this without the amazing people around me on the crew, my producers. I mean, I told you I had never done a documentary, and yes, it was immediately apparent that I had some skill in it, but like the people that were put around me were the best in the business. And so while there were things like passion and maybe some skills that were just innate, that wouldn't have made necessarily a great film. It was really all of these people who could carry me through issues and carry the film. And like it's hard for me to talk about the film and not talk about it as my film when I'm talking very specifically like that, but it totally is our film. And for anybody who has experienced filmmaking, this was one of those really team moments, because we went in and we shot this in, like I was saying, about 60 days, where we went through and we did all of these interviews, and it was just a core crew of like 12 of us that just was crisscrossing the state. And then because we were the replacement film, etc., the same kind of thing had to happen in post-production. We had three editors and an assistant editor, and basically when we were editing it, it was a 24-hour-a-day thing. We edited it in Venice, California, in LA, and I stayed there in Venice, a block away from where we were editing, and didn't matter when I went to that one room apartment, and when I got back, like any hour, I was leaving while people were working, and I was coming in while people were working. It was the most beautiful thing. And my initial desk in there was right next to a couple of interns, and it wasn't really made apparent that the director was coming in. You know, it was just, here's a spot for me to work. And these younger interns are going through and they're watching, like, you know, 1980s game tapes, you know, broadcasts of SMU football. And I just keep, you know, looking over their shoulder, and I'm like, man, you guys have, this is such a cool job you guys have on this. I mean, this is like, I am loving the fact that you're just getting to watch all these games. And they're like, yeah, it's pretty cool. So what do you do on the movie? It was good. I've gone way off topic on this, so why don't I let you bring me back to something you want to hear about?
I want to know what your favorite moment of the doc is. I already mentioned, like, I love the story about the Trans A&M. I also like the montage of guys saying the name Sherwood Blunt, which ends with Rod Jones saying what we're all thinking, that is a catchy name. His name was Sherwood. Do you have a favorite moment of the documentary? Because one of my favorite categories on this podcast usually is the big chill moment, which every sports movie has a good big chill moment. Documentary is usually not the same, but do you have a big moment in this one?
When you say the big chill moment, do you mean like the funeral scene at the beginning of the big chill, or you mean like
the moment that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up? It's like Roy Hobbs knocking out the lights in The Natural.
Ah, I see. Not like the movie, The Big Chill.
Not like you're the talking... movie, The Big Chill. No.
Right. Because I actually really like that movie.
Oh no, it's a good movie. It's just no, not talking about that though.
No, I, you know, I mean, I really like the intro of Eric Dickerson.
When it's the story about it goes to practice and says pick out who we're going. I like that one too.
Yeah, so that's actually Robin Budicki is the one telling that story, and Robin was the one that was the Here Comes Santa Claus guy.
Oh, that's incredible. That is fantastic.
Yeah, but I just, you know, I think maybe my favorite moment is Norm Hitzkus when he says, you know, there were teams in this state paying hundreds of thousands of dollars and winning three games. That's the definition of a loser.
And in that trademark voice he had too. You could argue best voice in the documentary.
That's pretty awesome. Yes, you could. He really, you know, he's got that voice of like old school radio, and he really is. He's been on the radio for 50 years. He's the longest running sports radio host in the country, in the nation, I believe. And he's definitely the only person to have broadcast every round of the NFL draft for the past 40 years, something like that. So he is a legend, and I am so glad to call him a friend. And my impression of him a second ago was not my my best impression of Norm. I'd have to come in with the idea of doing a Norm impression to nail it, or at least tell you some stories about when we went to Kenya together. But that can wait for another day.
I think that can wait for the next episode we do together, which would be very soon.
Because Norm is also in Brian and the Boz, and I had to argue for that because I was like, he was so good in Pony Excess. We gotta bring him back and have him in this one too. But yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no. Is there anything that was on the cutting room floor that you wish you could have gotten in? Maybe anything about some very good impermissible benefit stories, or just anything you wish you could have gotten in the film that got left out?
I mean, for the most part, it was the stories about the other schools, and that's mainly a personal fan thing. You know, we got people talking about the $100,000 slush fund that Jackie Sherrill had at A&M. You know, we got people talking a lot about Hartley Dykes, and Hartley or Hartley. He's such a legendary figure. The old stories about him sometimes call him Hartley, and then sometimes call him Hart Lee. But Hartley Dykes got six different schools in trouble in NCAA violations for recruitment of him, and so you know there were stories like that. And then for me, a big theme that we didn't get to explore is the idea of Texas really as the villain, and that's that there is a significant orange thread through the story, which basically we did get to present that the NCAA investigators first arrived on campus right after SMU went down to Austin and beat number 2 Texas, and it was literally the next Monday that they were on campus. But we didn't get to look into how many different people who were on the media end looking at SMU's impropriety, which is not necessarily an indictment on Texas in that manner, but University of Texas Journalism School is a great journalism school, and they put out a lot of great people. But you have to feel like that even with that, your perspective is going to have been like, I went to this big state school where we had to do nothing, where we did nothing wrong, or that the football program did nothing wrong. And then you have the the head of the infractions committee at the NCAA was a University of Texas law professor and a big supporter of the program. And then you have the two lead investigators on SMU or investigating SMU. One of the two marries DeLoss Dodd's daughter, so becomes the son-in-law of the UT the athletic director, and the other one eventually becomes the commissioner of the Big 12. So there was all of these different things, and certainly, you know, the idea of the UT people being sort of like, that program can't come in and beat us. But for me, I've just explained this all to you, and the fun that I would have had of us sort of like looking at the SMU fan who thinks that that UT had it in for them, and looking at those actual threads, it's fun for us to talk, or for me to talk about, but I don't know that it would have made for like fascinating TV unless we would have found like a smoking gun in there.
Yeah, and I think you need the smoking gun, because it would have. I think the good part about. I think why the documentary hits so well is it's not making excuses. It's an acknowledgement. There is the, you know, the other schools were doing this, and yes, SMU had to be the sacrificial lamb of the death penalty, and the reason that they'll never do it again. SMU had to walk or crawl or not walk at all. So Miami and USC and everyone else who has gotten severe sanctions could run, because SMU will be the only death penalty ever. But it If it had taken into account too many, like another program, especially UT, it would have come across more, I think, as someone like objectively watching it as a big excuse. And I think that the documentary was better served focused just on SMU. The thing that when you said about Texas being the villain, or at least Texas, setting up kind of that storyline, my first thought went to Eric Dickerson's recruiting story. When he talked about what the recruiter from Texas told him.
Yeah, when I was a kid, Texas was the Yankees of the Southwest Conference. So, of course, if you're not the Yankees, you're going to hate the Yankees. And if something bad happens to you, you're going to blame the Yankees. And it's not to say that the Yankees weren't at fault or didn't have any blame in it. But, like, not owning up to what you did, it makes it not enjoyable. The thing about Dickerson, though, that was such a typical story. So often within the film, we had 200 hours of audio for these interviews. And so we would often pick the same. There were several people who had similar stories about X, Y, and Z. And like, so if we had Eric Dickerson telling the story about why Texas did this, then we were going to use him over anybody else. Or if we had Eric Dickerson talking about David Stanley, which we did, we were going to have Eric Dickerson tell that story. I'm going to tell you my favorite moment of showing this film. I showed it to Eric at his house in Calabasas, and it was. Literally right after we finished. So this is not necessarily about Texas being the bad guy anymore, but it is about other schools and improper benefits. So I tell Eric, I know that I need Eric to be on the side of this film, because it's just going to be good for the premiere and for the early life of the film, and thus the rest of its life, for Eric to be on board at the beginning. And so I call him up and I say, hey, we're finishing we're getting the lock cut this week. Can I come up to your house, to Calabasas, and show you the film? And he was excited about it. He decides he's going to invite friends over. And so I get there, we pop in the DVD, and the DVD doesn't play. So he has invited all these friends, and now we can't watch the movie. So I call my producers, et cetera. Again, we were editing in Venice, so it's about 45 minutes from the studio to Dickerson's house, maybe an hour. And one of my producers, actually, I think the associate producer of the film, drove out with an iMac, with one of the original iMacs, with the movie on it, to all the way out to Dickerson's house, and then we watched it on that iMac. And by the time we did, everybody was gone. It was just Eric and I don't know if they're married, but his wife, the mother of his children. It was just the three of us watching it, he is wrapped in it the whole time. And when his grandmother is on screen, he was so excited about that. Like, I can't believe you found these clips of here. This is awesome. But like at the end of the movie, we've watched the whole thing, and of course I'm sweating like crazy, because I need him to like this film. I really, really need it. And he is, but still, it's stress. And at the end, we have that ending montage that sort of looks at all the other schools and the improper benefits and all these different things. And then USC comes on the screen, and he slaps me on the arm extremely hard and is like, you wouldn't believe how much they offered me. Basically, yeah, that USC, uh, uh, the, who... Whatever it was, Eric did not say that it was more than he would have gotten elsewhere, but it was pretty clear that that was the best offer was from USC. And of course, you know, we even had, like, David Stanley within the movie. We showed that Texas Tech was offering him more money than SMU. And I really feel like it's interesting that the guys that brought down the program were these disgruntled white dudes who, you know, just felt like they were, you know, passed over and felt like they were owed something, and they, you know, I mean, it wasn't any of the stars or anything like that, you know. It was just these guys who felt like they deserved something and didn't get it, and it was kind of, you know, both of those guys' stories that were the most key in sort of internally of bringing down the program. They both died of addiction, drug issues, which is, I mean, it's pretty devastating. And you know, it's hard for me to vilify them, but it is, you know, in the sense of like how their lives went. But it is interesting to me about how the people who ended up talking about it were not necessarily, you know, I'm going a little off track here, but it's a tough thing, you know, when you come out of high school and you're the star, and then it doesn't work out for you, and you feel like you need to find some reason why it didn't work out for you that's not your fault, especially when you're in the grips of addiction, because you don't want to be in that space. And so so while I say it's, you know, these disgruntled guys, I mean, I do feel for them, and there is a lot of anger towards them, obviously, still to this day. Sadly, they've both passed away.
On that kind of cheery note,
right?
But with you know, with the good Eric Dickerson story, I am that I'm a huge fan of this film. I think the love you have for SMU showed on screen. This has been an absolute pleasure. I am looking forward to talking about Brian and the Boz in a couple weeks, which, listeners of Big Screen Sports, everyone tune into that. We're going to have another episode talking about Brian and the Boz, and then maybe a couple comparison questions I have for both the films. Thad, where can the people find you? Or where can the people check out you know, any of the work that you want them to see?
So, Brian and the Boz and Pony Excess are both on ESPN Plus. So if you're a subscriber to ESPN Plus, you can stream them. You can also purchase them on iTunes and Amazon Prime. I do not get any money for buying them individually. So if you've got the ESPN Plus, don't worry about not having purchased it to help me out. The only thing I get is the joy that you've seen it. And speaking of, if I have 1 second, I just want to say that I'm incredibly grateful. Again, thank you for allowing me to be on this and to talk about this film and to tell these stories. And for me, it's just, it's really important that anybody out there who is listening to this and might have a passion for storytelling or a passion for anything that society might tell them it's going to be very difficult for you to succeed at this, and maybe you want to get a real job, or maybe you don't want to go into this thing that's just such a big bet. If you can look inside yourself and know that you have to do this, just go for it, because this is our only chance at this life. And if we can live in the present and understand that if we just put our effort into it and trust the process, beautiful things can happen. It's usually when we don't trust ourselves or feel like we're not good enough, even if we don't feel like we're good enough and we still take the step towards that impossible dream, the gifts that can come from it of just following that passion and allowing the chips to fall where they may. The amazing thing is when you just do it and you just take that step out into the infinite, you know, in faith, sometimes early on in hope, but in faith that your foot will land on solid ground, that path is going to lead you to places that you never dreamed of. I mean, I grew up wanting to be a filmmaker, and yes, I dreamed of winning awards and all this kind of stuff, accolades, but really, you know, it was just wanting to tell these stories, wanting to take that kid, that little kid that I was on the couch who sat there and loved Star Wars and not necessarily wanted to be a Jedi, but wanted to take people to these different worlds where everything could be okay. The idea of being able to take this leap and to see where it went, because I did not expect, I did not know about ESPN, and I tell this part of the story just because we were fortunate enough to win a Peabody Award for this film. A Peabody is a journalism award. I didn't grow up thinking about a Peabody Award, and the yeah, it's just the gift of having faith in a process or something, you know, and taking that step. I just want to encourage anybody who's listening to this. Yes, I understand that you need to be responsible and you can't be like 29, 30 year old me that was like, I don't care if I get eviction notices, I have to go after this. That is not going to be true for everybody. But if you have an opportunity that's staring at you and there's part of you saying, or not just part of you, but you can hear the universe telling you, or you can see the universe pointing you in that direction, just walk towards it, even if it looks like a whole lot of work, especially if it looks like a whole lot of work. You will be rewarded if you do it.
Well, Thaddeus, this was great. I am really looking forward to talking about Brian and the Boz in a couple weeks. Big Screen Sports listeners, tune into that, and we will catch you next Monday. Thanks so much for listening.